who's going to tell us about horizon thermodynamics. So Aaron,
all right, can you confirm that you can hear and see all right?
Yep.
Okay, great. So this is sort of going to be a review talk about progress in the last few years, mostly concerning horizon thermodynamics, mostly from the classical, semi-classical perspective. So, in the first part, I'm going to talk about static black hole thermodynamics, and some of these things have been known for a while, but there's also some interesting new things. So you're familiar with the Penrose diagram of an eternal black hole, and because I've recently been participating in the string theory community, you get to see asymptotically ADS boundary conditions, but a lot of this doesn't actually care about what the asymptotics are. So the important thing to bear in mind is the importance of the horizon generating killing symmetry, which is null along the horizon. So you have a bifurcation surface in the middle, and H plus is the future horizon, H minus is the past horizon, and you have a constant surface gravity, that's the zeroth law, where the surface gravity is the ratio between the amount of boost near the bifurcation surface and the amount of time translation out at infinity, which is actually a little awkward in the asymptotically ADS case because you have an arbitrary normalization for your clock out there. So we all know about standard thermodynamics of black holes, the classical, the original Hawking-Bekenstein version, where the energy is, of course, just the ADM mass, the temperature is proportional to the surface gravity, and S is given by the Bekenstein-Hawking area, plus there are quantum stringy, higher curvature, whatever quantum gravity you do, corrections to this. I see I didn't manage to change the string here to be more ecumenical for this conference, but you should make that change in your own head because it's quite fair. So there's the first law of horizon thermodynamics, the Clausius relation, that's the relation D equals TdS, and this should hold given the interpretations of these things. So you saw in the last talk, Berlinda's talk, that there's a very important state of the black hole that we get by Euclidean path integral. So if we go to imaginary time, the black hole, the boost looks like a rotation when we Wick rotate it. And we can think of it as a Euclidean path integral starting with the Euclidean version of the boundary conditions, and then we evolve in imaginary time with what at least formally will look like a path integral over whatever fields we have, like phi and so on, over and their action over this thing. This gets us a special Hartle-Hawking state of the static black hole that you can interpret as a wave function of the fields here, where the field should, of course, include the metric. Now, because the double-sided Euclidean path integral has rotational symmetry, one of the implications of that is if we interpret it as making a density matrix, similar to what Herman was talking about in his talk, if we consider it there to be a Hartle-Hawking density matrix on one side, then the quantum state of those fields on this background is going to be a thermal state, thermal with respect to K, which is the killing energy, which looks like a boost energy close to the horizon. Now, when you go back to Lorentzian signature, you have to remember that this is the killing vector that defines the that you can use to evolve with on the wedge-shaped region that's to the right of the bifurcation surface here. So that is the Lorentzian version of the Hartle-Hawking state is thermal with respect to what we think of as like Schwarzschild time evolution outside of this black hole. Now, in ADS-CFT, we think of the thermality of the Hartle-Hawking state as related to the fact that a dual path integral that lives on the Euclidean boundary will give you the thermofield double state of two boundary theories that holographically are supposed to encode this bulk. One of them is a CFT living on the left, and the other is a CFT living on the right, and then you get a thermofield double state of these CFTs. That's how we interpret an ADS-CFT. I think there's good reason to believe that something similar will happen in other approaches to quantum gravity besides string theory, since a lot of this, as I think Verlinde was trying to emphasize, is a question of how you interpret path integrals, and most formalisms of quantum gravity make some room for gravitational path integrals, although Lorentz symmetry is quite important for being able to interpret it as a thermal state. Now, because of this entanglement between the two sides, you might guess that if you have two disconnected boundary theories in ADS-CFT, one that lives on the left and one that lives on the right. And if you had to guess, you might think that the left CFT is dual to the light blue shaded wedge on the left, while the right CFT is dual to the pink shaded region on the right. And that turns out, in the context of ADS-CFT, and I believe probably it will turn out more broadly, to be not only correct, but part of a bigger statement called entanglement wedge reconstruction that I will mention later. Now, I'm going to go back to statements now that are true independently of holography. And one of them is that if you consider this Hartle-Hawking state, and instead of looking at the wedge region on one side, we look at the horizon instead, which is a null surface, a codimension one null surface that's shown in blue on this diagram, then the Hartle-Hawking state from that perspective is the ground state with respect to a funny sort of null translation symmetry that's like translating the affine parameter on the horizon. And this is kind of a funny thing because the symmetry with respect to which the Hartle-Hawking state, it looks like a vacuum state, is actually not a Killing symmetry of the entire space-time. It's only a symmetry specifically of the horizon itself. Now, this is actually a very old fact shown by Israel, by K. Wald Sewell, and some other people, but not a lot of people know it, actually, so it's worth mentioning. Actually, though, there's a stronger statement that's true, which is that the Hartle-Hawking state is actually a ground state with respect to the null energy that is integrated along any light ray L on the horizon H. As a reminder, we're still talking about the static case where we are not considering, it's still a Killing symmetric space-time, and we're doing quantum field theory in curved space-time. So if you see this light ray L on the diagram, B, the bifurcation surface is a sphere, so I've drawn it like a circle going around the cylinder, and L is a light ray going along the horizon. Now, if we take V, the affine null coordinate, then the quantum field theory stress tensor on the Hartle-Hawking state exactly satisfies the integral of TdV dV for that state equals zero. Note that I've written this not just as an expectation value statement, but as an eigenvalue statement, which is a stronger statement, but is logically implied if the expectation value statement is true, if you believe the average null energy condition, which says that in any state, this expectation value has got to be non-negative. If the only way you could have an expectation value be zero without the actual value being zero is if there are fluctuations. But if there are fluctuations, it would sometimes be positive and sometimes be negative, and it can't be negative. So this is actually an exact quantum statement. It's the only statement you could make that assigns it to a constant that's compatible with Lorentz invariants. Now, you should believe the average null energy condition for reasons I'll mention later. But anyway, another slide first. Because the average null energy generates, so average null energy without the condition, I mean the quantity just this integrated quantity here. Because that's the generator with respect to these null translations, the Hartle-Hawking state turns out to be thermal, not just with respect to the wedge that I showed you before that's outside the bifurcation surface, which is shown here, which is this integral, which is like an integral of the Killing energy across the H plus, or the portion of H plus that's to the future of B. But actually, there's also a thermality property that is true above any arbitrary slice of the horizon, where if you look at this formula in the upper right, I've here translated it by an arbitrary function, capital Vy, that gives you that allows you to define a push at this green surface on the event horizon that's basically the V coordinate, null coordinate, is an arbitrary function of the transverse Y coordinates. Rob, can you tell me whether my cursor is visible to people?
Sorry, could you show me your cursor again?
I'm moving my cursor around on the screen.
No, that's fine. I can see that.
Because I don't want to move it around if it turns out nobody can see it. All right, good. So I've done my best to show the wedge-shaped region on the Penrose diagram with some crude art. It sort of doesn't really make sense because we're breaking the rotational symmetry, and on the Penrose diagram, each point is a sphere, but I hope you can see from this sort of vague, fuzzy region here that there's something wiggly around in the suppressed dimensions, so that you just have a sort of partial wedge here. And you'd be, from a quantum field theory and curved space-time perspective, you might be interested in the modular energy, which is the energy with respect to which this wedge region is thermal. And what I'm saying is that modular energy, although it would be very non-local if you evaluate on a space-like slice, if you evaluate it on the horizon itself, it turns out to have a very nice local formula in terms of integrals of the stress tensor, which turns out to be basically the fact I needed about horizons to prove the quantum version of the second law in what was my dissertation research. Now, some of that was old. There's some very exciting new things in the last few years, though. Mainly is that the biggest development on this front is that we now know that most of the statements I just told you about, I think all of the statements I told you about, should continue to hold when you have a general interacting quantum field theory with a UV fixed point. For example, until surprisingly recently, nobody knew how to prove the average null energy condition for a general quantum field theory, but in 2016, there were two proofs of it, one of which used the concept of relative entropy, monotonicity of relative entropy, and some CFT perturbation theory of the entanglement entropy. And that was the proof by Faulkner, Wei, Pericker, and Wang. And the other one was a proof by Hartman, Kundu, and Tajini that uses causality constraints, basically in the light cone OPE, as two operators approach null separation to each other. You can get a sum rule that shows that there's a positive quantity here, and that positive quantity turns out to be the average null energy condition. Also, the statement I told you about the modular Hamiltonian on null slices was derived for a general interacting field theory that by, at least if there's a CFT UV limit, that by Cassini, Teste, and Torba in 2017. And that was quite interesting because in a follow-up paper, they were able to give an entanglement proof of the A theorem in four dimensions, which is a monotonicity under RG flow, similar to the C theorem in two dimensions. Now, for quantum field theory in curved space-time, the average null energy condition actually has some exceptions, although not on these generators of killing horizons we were talking about. It turns out that the average null energy condition is only required to hold along achronal complete null geodesics, meaning that no two points are related by time-like curves. And another way of saying this is that in a gravitational field, most light rays you could pick are not the fastest possible. For example, if you have a star and the light ray, if you have the sun and the light ray bends around the sun, then there's a Shapiro delay that slows down the light ray relative to light rays that are farther away from the sun. But in this very nice paper by Graham and Olam, they argued that semi-classically in self-consistent scenarios, you could impose this achronal anech, and it would actually have most of the same implications for proving nice general relativity results that you would get from the average null energy condition. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about dynamics, and I'm going to make some classical statements, although one of the important payoffs at the end of, towards the end of the talk is going to be that almost all of these statements also have generalizations to semi-classical quantum gravity. So first of all, it's helpful to define the expansion of a codimension two surface in space-time. So we have mu, which is a space-like surface. And if I shoot out light rays going outwards from it, then I can define the expansion as the rate of change of infinitesimal area element with respect to the affine coordinate v. Per unit infinitesimal area. So I've written out all the d's and deltas here more explicitly than people usually do when they define this formula. In the case where the outgoing light rays satisfy theta equals zero, sometimes people also impose the ingoing light rays have to satisfy theta u less than or equal to zero, where u is the other null direction, we call this surface mu marginally trapped. Such surfaces play an extremely important role in the Penrose singularity theorem. Now, using the expansion theta, we can talk about different notions of horizons because in general relativity, in black hole thermodynamics, we want to talk about the fact that the area of the horizon is given by some entropy. But once we make the black hole dynamical, there are actually several different competing notions of what we mean by the horizon, and therefore competing notions of entropy and second law, and so on. So I'm going to show some different kinds of surfaces that people have proved things about. The first surface is the extremal HRT surface, which is used in holographic entanglement entropy. And this is the surface shown by this blue X here. And that's the surface where both the ingoing and the outgoing expansions vanish, which is the same as saying the first order change of the surface in any direction doesn't change the area. This surface is very important in ADS-CFT because it's believed to give the entanglement entropy between the left and right boundary CFTs. The another concept you could have is the trapping horizon, which is a surface. Actually, there's multiple such surfaces depending on how you foliate the space-time, but a trapping horizon can be defined as a codimension one surface that is foliated by surfaces, each of which is marginally trapped. And I haven't shown what the matter is doing, but depending on what the matter is doing in this space-time, the trapping surface could be partially space-like and partially time-like. Non-generically, it can be light-like. You see, because I'm assuming in this whole Penrose diagram that there's matter, that's why the space-time has been extended into a long wormhole that has a bigger causal diagram going from left to right. The other notion of horizon is what I've been calling H plus, and H minus is the event horizon, which is defined, so H plus is defined as the boundary of the past of what can reach time-like infinity over here. On the right here, we have a space-time that is formed from collapse, where you just have the future versions of these things. Oddly, in the time-like version of a future trapping horizon, it actually goes to the past instead of the future. Finally, for the fourth type of surface you could consider, you could also wonder, are there any statements you can make about the thermodynamics of general null surfaces? And this is confusing because the null surfaces that approach the singularity can be decreasing in area. Now, classically, if we assume the null energy condition that says that TVV is greater than or equal to zero, where V is any null vector point anywhere in the space-time, then the following statements are generically true, as are their time reversals. Non-generically, you might be able to saturate some of these inequalities. So one statement that's always true is that the extremal surface X and the trapping horizons always lie inside the future horizon. Another statement is that H plus has increasing area. That's the Hawking version of the second law. Another statement is that the future trapping horizon has increasing area going both in its time-like pastward segments and in its space-like outward segments. And there was a nice paper a few years ago by Busso and Engelhardt where they showed that when the trapping horizon is stitched together to form what they call the holographic screen, where portions of it had different signature, it's still true that the area increases monotonically in the sense defined by trekking through the surface in a consistent direction. So these are two different versions of the second law that says area increases. And if there's two different versions of the second law, ultimately we'll need two different ways of deriving it from statistical mechanics of quantum gravity. Another statement you can make is that the extremal surface X always has less area than the causal bifurcation, the causal surface where H plus and H minus meet. And one statement that's holographic is that the area of X gives the leading order entropy in ADS CFT of each of these two dual CFTs. Now, one thing to notice about the surface X is unlike the other surfaces, which are codimension one surfaces, so that their area changes with time, the HRT surface here is a codimension two surface, and so it gives, if its area is an entropy, it's an entropy that doesn't change with time. So from the perspective of holography, where people are mostly assuming that the information in the boundary theory is not lost, this is of course its own set of controversies in black hole thermodynamics, but people are mostly assuming now that this X surface gives the fine-grained von Neumann entropy in quantum gravity of the dual quantum system, whereas because T and H have areas that increase with time, if we are going to give a statistical interpretation of them, it must involve some sort of coarse-grained entropy. Now, for those who may not be quite familiar with the StatMech terminology, let me just remedially review this. In the ordinary second law, we could have a box of gas, and if you start with some special initial conditions, and then you let time pass, if the gas starts, for example, with all the atoms in one corner, as time passes, it spreads out. And this is a prototypical example of what we mean by entropy increasing. Now, you can define a fine-grained entropy. Quantum mechanically, it's minus trace rho log rho, the von Neumann entropy. But this quantity is actually conserved under unitary time evolution. And so there's no non-trivial second law that allows this entropy to actually increase with time. The general solution to this problem in StatMech is something called coarse graining. You have to find a way to say that you can only measure certain aspects of the system so that you, in some sense, forget about the detailed correlation of the molecules as time passes. And that means you're going to need some way of calculating a coarse-grained entropy, which has the property that the coarse-grained entropy is bigger than the fine-grained entropy. There are, in fact, multiple approaches to this. In terms of horizon thermodynamics, so far, as far as I know, there's only a story along these lines for the trapping horizon, not the future horizon. So I'm going to describe a couple papers I wrote with Netta Engelhardt now, where we defined this, a coarse-grained entropy in a sort of way inspired by Jaynes, where you define the coarse-grained entropy by maximizing an entropy subject to constraints. So what we did is we looked at a marginally trapped surface, and that could be a leaf of this trapping horizon. And then we say, given the knowledge of all the classical field data that is outside this surface, you can pick any interior that's compatible with the field data outside, because the interiors are what you don't know. So the idea is it's basically a classical GR problem. If we specify the data outside the surface, what's the data inside the surface that maximizes the entropy? Our result was that for a wide class of marginally trapped surfaces satisfying certain other reasonable inequalities, it turns out that this outer entropy is exactly equal to the area of the surface itself. Now, the way we do it, here, there's a wedge region that has all of the data outside the mu, the marginally trapped surface. And basically what we said is that there's a construction where you, a valid solution to the constraint equations in GR, where you glue onto this wedge a null surface that's stationary. And then when you go far enough down this null surface, you always encounter a holographic entropy surface X that where both thetas vanish. So this is null, one of the thetas vanishes, but here both thetas vanish. And if you want to complete it into a space-time that has looks like a wormhole geometry, you can do a CPT reflection around it and make another asymptotic region here. Now, everything I just said is a classical GR construction, except for the part where if you take on faith, the bit that comes from holography, that the area of this extremal surface can be interpreted as the fine-grained von Neumann entropy in some Hilbert space, then that shows that the area of this surface mu is the coarse-grained entropy. This construction maximizes the entropy subject to the constraint of everything you know, which we're assuming is everything outside this marginally trapped surface. So it's sort of an analogy between StatMech and black hole thermodynamics. The difference is we're thinking of the things we don't know, not as microscopic information in a gas, but as things that are behind some surface, that some horizon-like surface. This actually gets a statistical explanation for the area law whenever the trapping horizon is space-like, because as you go along the surface, you're maximizing the entropy subject to fewer constraints. That proves that the area of the surface increases. We already knew that. Sean Hayward proved in the 90s, but this shows that there appears to be a StatMech explanation for that fact in at least in quantum gravity, if you're willing to endorse this holographic entropy interpretation. I want to mention the quantum corrections to this story. So one thing you should know now is given any Cauchy surface sigma and a surface E, which divides it into two regions, an interior and an exterior, you can define an entanglement entropy of the quantum fields on this surface, where rho is the density matrix restricted to one side or the other. Now, this entanglement entropy is UV divergent, but fortunately, the UV divergences are local in quantum field theory. And that has the nice property, because the divergences on E are local, that they can always be absorbed into counter terms and made to be finite. And we call that the generalized entropy. So the generalized entropy is the sum of two terms.
Aaron, 5 minutes?
Yes. The expectation value of an area and the quantum entanglement entropy that is outside of it. And then there might need to be counter terms for subleading things. The leading order divergence of the entanglement entropy scales is the area and is equivalent to the usual renormalization of 1 over G. This suggests that there's a way to extend all the facts about classical GR I told you to semi-classical situations if you just, instead of looking at the area, you look at the generalized entropy. So you define a quantum expansion as the rate of change per unit area of the generalized entropy with respect to the affine parameter. I'm going to skip past this a little fast. But then there are statements you can make about how this quantity, this quantum expansion, has an inequality obeys when you take another null derivative. Basically, the quantum, the generalized entropy has a focusing property, so it has a certain second derivative that's always negative. If you take the g goes to zero limit on a stationary null surface, you actually get an interesting version of an energy condition that is true in quantum field theory that says the expectation value of the null-null component of the stress tensor is bounded by a certain second derivative of the entanglement entropy. There's now a general proof of this by Kahn and Faulkner for general quantum field theories. There's a bunch of citations here below that show that in interacting CFTs, interestingly, this equation is often saturated in all states. So now the statements I just made about classical things, we can now map them onto quantum situations. We just need to change our definitions a little bit. The extremal surface has to be the surface where the first order change of this quantum expansion, the generalized entropy vanishes. We use the generalized entropy instead of the area. And similarly, the trapping horizon has to again be defined by saying the derivative of the generalized entropy vanishes. Then all of the statements I just made, their analogous statements, have now been shown to be true in quantum gravity, where all of these first four statements are semi-classical statements, and the fifth statement is a statement about ADS CFT. When we take into account the first quantum order in H bar, in light of the time, I'm going to actually skip this part. But sorry, I'm going to just say, you can, from this formula, that the CFT is given by the generalized entropy of an extremal surface, you can derive that the same statement is true about their modular Hamiltonians. And if you use statements about the relative entropy, you can actually use this to derive the statement I promised you earlier, which is called entanglement wedge reconstruction, that says you can show semi-classically that using this holographic entanglement entropy formula, that the pink region, the wedge on the right, is what's dual to the right CFT, and the blue region here is what's dual to the left CFT. The same thing can be done. The coarse graining prescription I mentioned can also be generalized to the semi-classical setting. It's also interesting to talk about higher curvature corrections. We now have good formulas for that too. There's the well-known Wald entropy formula, but this is not valid when there are for stationary black holes. And there's a whole group of people who have worked out the quantum corrections for surfaces in dynamical settings, where you have to take into account things like the extrinsic curvature squared of the codimension two surface to define an entropy for it. It's now known there's actually a focusing relation for the higher curvature entropy for arbitrary metric scalar field theories of gravitation if you are doing a first order perturbation around a killing horizon. Then to first order, there's a focusing relation in terms of some perturbing matter stress tensor. You can always construct an entropy density whose second derivative is proportional to the stress energy tensor of the matter field. Here, H is the analog of the Einstein tensor for this higher curvature gravity. So TVV equals HVV is just the equation of motion of this theory. There are people who try and take this to higher order, but it's very difficult. Now, I don't really want to talk about this slide because I'm out of time. I just wanted to remind you that there's this old story where people have interpreted this generalized entropy as being a stat-mech entropy of degrees of freedom outside the horizon. And this is related to the induced gravity hypothesis of Sakharov. But since I'm out of time, I don't usually get to talk about this slide anyway. So I think we should switch to the questions now.
Are there some questions in the chat also?
Yeah, let's start by thanking Aaron. That's very nice. So there are some questions in the chat. Actually, I'm going to turn to Eric Curiel, who writes, all the classical statements you make about changes in the area of various horizons depend on the null energy condition, also depend on assumption of some nice causality condition for the space-time. Do analogous holographic statements that the area of the extremal surface of the fine-grain entropy also assume such causality conditions?
Generally, the answer to this is yes. That is, none of these semi-classical proofs are any nicer. They're never nicer than the classical version. So anything that's in the fine print of the classical version, you should assume is hidden somewhere in the fine print of the quantum version as well.
Okay, I'm going to turn to Laurent, who has his hand raised. So Laurent, do you want to ask a question?
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hello, Aaron. Very, very nice talk and very clear. It's beautiful. I have a question about somehow the second part of the talk, the definition of the generalized entropy.
Good.
That is, as you mentioned there, there is some kind of you need to do renormalization in a theory that where we don't control really renormalization, right? So are you kind of assuming that somehow your renormalization scheme reabsorb all the divergences into a finite 4G, or and if so, is there any evidence that it works, or what is
right?
The,
right, there is.
Is that a strong assumption? What how much does depend on this renormalization ambiguity?
That's right. Actually, there are a lot of questions. There are multiple questions about this. So let me say right. So the main story here is that the entanglement entropy, of course, S out, depends on your choice of cutoff. The important thing to realize here is that the counter terms in your gravitational action, like Newton's constant, also depends on your cutoff, because they get renormalized by loop corrections. So there's an old story that began in the 90s, although several aspects of it have only recently been worked out, that says that if you take into account the fact that both the S out and the coefficients in the Bekenstein, Hawking, and other counter terms both depend on lambda, the statement is that these dependencies on the cutoff actually cancel each other out, so that the generalized entropy doesn't depend on your UV cutoff lambda. So for example, if I have my UV cutoff at some length scale, and then I move it to a larger length scale, I'm now seeing less entanglement entropy S out, but the statement is that Newton's constant also shifts in such a way that we've just moved things from the S out term to the expect to the 1 over G times the expectation value of A term. So it moves things. So changing the place where you put the cutoff just moves things from one term to another term in such a way that the total remains the same. Now you might wonder whether the renormalization of G, you need to do that, is the same as the usual renormalization of G that you would have if you were doing Feynman diagrams. And the answer, with some technical statements about some special cases, the answer seems to be, generally seems to be yes, that it is the same renormalization of 1 over G if you interpret everything correctly. There's several digressions I could go on this that I will not, but morally, I think the answer to the question is yes, and this is an important consistency property. Basically, it says that the operation of going from your partition function slash action, the operation of going from your effective action to going to your entropy, the generalized entropy, is an action that ought to commute with renormalization. So it's a commuting square.
Okay. What about, I'm a bit surprised by, I mean, I understand as an hypothesis, but I'm a bit surprised by that as a proof, given we don't have really a good control on renormalization. And I would expect that, you know, generally, if you have a renormalization scheme, you need to replace this area operator by a more non-local operator. That's what usually happens, right? So you need to do a Hamiltonian renormalization of the operator you're talking
right,
about.
Right, now I should say there's a whole bunch of subtleties here when you start making your matter fields be gauge, which have now been worked out for the case of Maxwell fields. But I think there's still some open issues when the field is the linearized graviton itself.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm going to move ahead. I'm actually going to ask Sumati Surya to unmute and ask your question directly, if you can.
Okay, great. So hi, Aaron. Thanks for a really nice talk. What I wanted to ask was this new quantum null energy condition that you have. I mean, typically when we talk about these energy conditions, there's this concern that regular quantum field theories don't satisfy them. And so there is this effort to do, you know, get these quantum interface conjectures where we talk about how much negative energy is actually allowed and, you know, for how long can you have a huge amount of negative energy and so on and so forth. And that's oftentimes, you know, these criticisms from the quantum field theory perspective that, you know, a lot of these singularity theorems aren't necessarily robust against quantum fluctuations. So I just wanted to know, first of all, with this Q and Nick, whether whether ordinary quantum fields satisfy this. I mean, I can't parse this statement well enough to ask it, to understand that. And
the first question is yes. The Cannon and Faulkner is a general proof that Lorentz invariant quantum field theories will satisfy the Q Nick. And in terms of the hierarchy of inequalities, it's pretty high up. So from the QNEC, you can derive the ANEC, and you can, that has a separate proof. But from the, if what you want to know is what's necessary for the generalized second law to be true, if you couple the quantum field theory to gravity, this is a stronger statement.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thanks.
But let me also say regarding the quantum interest conjecture, on the one hand, when you say no need, that depends on what you want to do, of course. If what you wanted to do was show that the second law isn't violated, then there's no need to think about the quantum interest conjecture. But I think this is a way of making the quantum interest conjecture more precise in that it says that if you have a spike of positive energy and another spike of negative energy, but the spike of positive energy has to be bigger, there's actually a physical reason for it, and that's that the quantum fields in between the two spikes have a shifted value of S prime. In special to the case of a 1+1 dimensional CFT. There's actually a stronger version of this quantum null energy condition from which you can actually prove the quantum interest conjecture. In that case, a version of the quantum interest conjecture. And interestingly, it actually says that if you have a negative spike of energy, there's actually only a finite amount of affine parameter you can go before the repayment required goes to infinity.
Okay, so that's really interesting.
Worse than the bankers.
Okay, that's great. Wonderful. Thank you. Thanks a lot.
I can tell you more about that on the Slack.
That would be great. Thank you.
Okay, I think we're running a little bit behind, but let's thank Aaron again for his wonderful talk. And we have a break now until 11 o'clock. Again, there's a Remo room where people, I encourage you to circulate and discuss. But I'll remind you as well, as Aaron just said, if you go to the top of the chat box for these morning's talks, there's a Slack channel where you can still send Aaron questions, and I'm sure he'll be happy to address them. So that's it for this first session this morning. Thank you again to both speakers.